I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Wayne Hoffman, author of the new book, How She Died, a Jewish murder mystery that was solved a century later. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom, Chag Sameach, the Kasher, and Aziz and Pesach. Happy Passover. Now, before we talk about the great Freedom Festival of Passover, now on its second day of the 7 or 8 days of Matzah Joy, I have to mention a news item that appeared last week, which I was aware of for some time prior to the official vote. It was the ending of an era decision by the leadership of Hebrew Union College, the historic rabbinical seminary in America, to stop ordaining rabbis at its Cincinnati campus. That decision was long in coming and has been bandied about for many years, but it was still highly controversial within the Reform movement of Judaism. Poll of Reform rabbis opposed closing it to rabbinical ordination by a 3-to-1 margin. In the interest of full disclosure, I was ordained out of the Cincinnati campus of HUC, and my grandfather, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan, taught theology and liturgy there for 35 years, long before I was born. My grandparents actually met in a class there. My dad more or less grew up at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, and when I moved there to start my fourth year of rabbinical school a long time ago, I expected it would be a good place to connect with a great heritage. The Cincinnati campus of HUC was the first rabbi's seminary in America, and even its phone number had 1876 in it, year of the first ordination of rabbis in the U.S. Important Jewish history lived there, and I love history. Sadly, to be honest, what I found at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, besides my grandfather's photo on the wall, was a truly weird place of odd little academic fiefdoms, encrusted traditions that made no sense, and incredibly idiosyncratic professors, that's being kind, who had been on the job much too long or were, well, deeply peculiar in unique ways. After truly enjoying my first years of rabbinical school in Jerusalem and then Los Angeles at HUC campuses there, I spent 2 unhappy years at HUC in Cincinnati, paying dues and waiting to get out and go to work as a rabbi already. One of my most vivid memories of the kind of bizarre time capsule experiences common to the HUC Cincinnati campus was when we had a birthday celebration at Shabbat morning services in the chapel there for Professor Jacob Marcus, may he rest in peace, for his 98th birthday, I think. We had a cake and many candles, and while those candles burned, Rabbi Jake Marcus, ordained in Cincinnati in 1920, the doyen of American Jewish historians, got up on his walker to speak. His voice was still strong, if strident and a little scary, and he said, well, shouted, kind of croaked in an appropriately terrifying way that resounded through the chapel, "I hear there are rumors about closing this campus. If that happens, I will come back from the grave, I promise you." You know what? I believe Dr. Marcus. Maybe he's coming now. The decision by the current HUC brass to not close the campus exactly, but simply stop having rabbinical students ordained there in order to save money and face the realities of diminished enrollments and decreasing interest in attending that campus, well, look, it hasn't made sense for decades to have 4 Hebrew Union College campuses in 2 countries produce a total of 25 or 30 or maybe 40 Reform rabbis a year, and now they just won't do it anymore. I know many of my rabbinical colleagues feel this is the wrong decision. I mean, there are still three campuses of HUC ordaining rabbis. I must say that while the historical connection to Cincinnati may be lost, that particular place was a decrepit, haunted house of weird, unhappy memories for many people over the years, and recent revelations of decades of sexual misconduct by professors and administrators do not improve its reputation. It was long past time to retire HUC Cincinnati as a training ground for rabbis. In happier news, we had a fabulous Seder at my home, and then a giant one at Congregation Beit Simcha, also wonderful for Pesach. And so to play us in this morning, here's 613's Passover song for this year. It's a Billy Joel Passover, all a cappella and a lot of fun.
On a Seder day, the annual crowds shuffled in. There's a Zaidi sitting next to me, making Kiddush for all of his kin. But
he says, sons, do you have any inquiries? Like why we trade bread for matzah?
That was the a cappella Jewish group 613 and their Billy Joel Passover. Thanks to my dad, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, for forwarding me that one. Of course, Billy Joel is Jewish from Long Island, descended from German Jewish immigrants to New York. You know, true crime murder mysteries are usually about fairly recent deaths, but what do you do when a family story about a shocking killing turns out to be based in fiction? And the facts, well, they're much more compelling than the story you heard growing up. That fascinated our guest this morning, Wayne Hoffman, a journalist, and it makes for a compelling tale of discovery. We'll hear all about it when we return in a moment, here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Wayne Hoffman is the author of a fascinating new, I guess, memoir, investigative memoir called The End of Her, Racing Against Alzheimer's to Solve a Murder. He's a journalist and novelist. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So this is really an extraordinary book, I have to say. First, beautifully written, very clear, lucid, but what a story. Tell me when you first suspected that this, well, great family story wasn't really fully true.
To be frank, I suspected this family legend was not true when I was a child. The family legend seemed too preposterous and just not plausible to me. But I never said anything until I was about 40, when my mother developed dementia, and I decided to finally tell her that I never believed the story she told me my whole life.
The story is that, why don't you tell it? You're a better storyteller, I think.
The story I was told, which is the story my mother was told as a child, is that my great-grandmother was murdered. She was shot while she was breastfeeding her baby outside on the front porch in winter in Winnipeg, and that she was killed by a drive-by sniper, leaving the baby at the breast unharmed.
That's
the story that I never believed. You can tell from the way I'm telling you.
Yes, of course. Believed. I mean, first of all, nobody breastfeeds outdoors in Winnipeg in the winter. I can't even imagine.
No, and there were no drive-by snipers a century ago targeting nursing mothers in broad daylight.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure there are so many today, thank God.
No, true. But at least today you could drive by. Then on a dirt road in a city with very few cars, it would have been even harder.
In a Model T or something.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a remarkable story. Everybody, your mother, who was, as you say in the book, not one to question authority, accepted it. Everybody in the family accepted it. Were you really the first person to call BS on this, as you put in your book?
I was the first person to say it out loud. I think there was skepticism beyond me in the family. I think even my mother had her doubts sometimes, but no one ever truly said this isn't the real story until I did.
So once you said that, it led really to the whole rest of the story, which is both about your close relationship with your mother and then the challenge of trying to solve this ancient murder with a witness who is going away, probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah. I never thought this would be a book because I didn't think there was that much to find, and I didn't think it would take this long. I thought it would take, you know, a week or two. I'd Google something, I'd find the real story, I'd tell my mother, and that'd be the end. That's a paragraph. That's not a book. But it took more like a decade. And while I was finding the answers, my mother was deteriorating. And those two things affected each other. Her decline motivated me to keep searching. And the searching gave me something to hold on to while I was losing her.
And we will explore that journey, that investigation, much more when we come back in a moment on To Jewish with our guest, Wayne Hoffman. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue, well, kind of new, in the Catalina foothills in northwest Tucson, we're 3 years old, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community striving every day to serve God with joy. A wonderful progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services Friday night at 6:30, Saturday morning at 10 a.m., or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. BeitSimcha Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person or, of course, online. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night or Saturday, or come to our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson, or come in person for Torah study at 9 a.m. on Saturday mornings. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and we have a lot of them, are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or email me, rabbi@BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our religious school at Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Beit Simcha, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona and its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, JewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
And happy Passover, Aziz and Pesach, as we say.
And to you.
So I have a story. My dad used to, we've been talking about history the last couple of weeks. My dad used to buy us new clothes before Rosh Hashanah every year. And one year I couldn't go with my dad and my brother to the garment district in L.A. because that was the best deals. And to the Russian guy who sold suits there, Russian Jewish guy. And so he asked my dad, where's your son? And my dad said, oh, he's at university now. He's at UCLA. He's studying. And the Russian guy said, what's he studying? And as my dad says, when they ask you what you're studying in Russia, they mean, what are you going to do for a living? What's your profession? And my dad said, oh, he's studying history. And the Russian Jewish guy shook his head. He said, in history, in America, no good. He said, in Russia, very good. Every 5 years, change history. So we think of history as fixed, immutable. Obviously, that has changed in recent years, but there have been lots of cultures where they just rewrite their history as soon as there's a new ruler.
Absolutely. And one of the many interesting things about this subject, I think, is that history is always told from the vantage point of the winners, right? That's an old saw that rings true, because who gets to write the history books and control the curricula and all that? But what I noticed when I was teaching for many years at the University of Arizona is that in our country, the United States of America, when people say, oh, that's history, they mean that's irrelevant, it's past, it couldn't be less interesting, it's dismissive. Jews don't share that attitude necessarily. And in this regard, at least, we are much closer to Europeans who know an astonishing amount, at least about their own history. So a Serb may not know much about the history of Norway, but he or she will know an incredible amount about the history of Serbia. Very few Americans show that inclination. And so it's easy to fool them about what their own history is because they've never studied it. And it's interesting to go around the world and see, you know, which countries are really deeply attached to their history and which parts of their history they're attached to. You know, the French have a very long and very colorful history, but there are certain parts that they all know and certain parts that very few of them know. They all know about and glorify in almost mythical ways the French Revolution in 1789. They ignore some of the nastier parts of that whole process.
The terror, for example, which...
Right. They all know about Asterisk and the Gauls and the conflicts with the Romans. They all know about Charlemagne. They all know that Charles Martel defeated the Muslims.
At Tours, right?
Right. But even though they're European and they know a lot more about their own history than we do, it's still spotty. There are parts that they either choose to overlook or just aren't that interested in. So I think every nation, every culture, every group has a selective reading of history. Whether we like it or not, history's so complicated, we're going to have to pick and choose.
You know, when you think about it, Jewish history, we might have the longest history of any people in the world. I guess China goes back pretty deep in terms of a continuous history. And I think that Jews don't know so much about their history. But I would also say that one of the really interesting things that we've seen in recent years, and maybe we can continue this next week, you know, the 20th century, we see the history as the Holocaust and Israel. And there's a lot of Jews who don't know much about Jewish history before that. Something to maybe consider as in this series we're doing on history. Listen, enjoy the rest of Pesach now that Seders are in our history and past. And Chag Sameach.
Also to you. Thanks.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service for Pesach. A blind man sits on a park bench during Passover. A rabbi sits down next to him, takes out his lunch, including, you know, Pesach matzah. Seeing the blind man has nothing to eat, taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of matzah and gives it to the blind guy. A few minutes later, the blind man turns, taps the rabbi on his shoulder, and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, a special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, that classic Pesach joke. You see, the blind man thought the matzah was actually writing in Braille, and... And now a word of Torah. Because of how Passover falls this year, having begun Friday night and continuing through the end of the week, we have an interesting bifurcation of Torah readings this Shabbat. In Israel, all Jews celebrate 7 days of Passover, while in the diaspora, there's a difference between conservative and Orthodox Jews, who celebrate 8 days of Pesach, and Reform Jews, who celebrate just 7 days. For Jews who celebrate the eighth day of Pesach, this Saturday's Torah reading comes from Deuteronomy. It includes the commandments for celebrating the Passover in biblical times, as well as other festivals' celebrations. In contrast, Jews in Israel on Shabbat will read the Torah portion of Achrei Molot from Leviticus, the regular weekly portion. Some Reform Jews outside of Israel officially, if one can say anything having to do with the Reform movement is ever official, anyway, they officially do something odd. They divide the weekly portion of Achrei Molot into two parts, reading one section this week and the next section next week. That means, anyway, that for a few weeks now, the Torah as read in Israel, and even in America, will differ from the portion read in most diaspora synagogues. It all evens out eventually, but this year, not until August 6th. Torah portions of Deuteronomy, Devarim, the first section, after we combine the Torah portions of Matot Maaseh at the end of Numbers the week before. Frankly, that's a long time when Jews will be reading different Torah portions on the same Shabbat. Couple of months. In any case, since in our own congregation Beit Simcha will read an eighth-day Torah reading for Passover, we're reminded of the fact that Passover, like Shavuot and Sukkot, was a pilgrimage festival, a time when our ancestors physically walked to Jerusalem, celebrating the holiday as a national community. 3 times a year we were supposed to travel to this central shrine, the Temple in Jerusalem, and observe the rituals of the festival in the holiest place on earth. It's doubtful that all but the most pious, and maybe the wealthiest Jews, fulfilled this mitzvah three times every year, but it's equally likely that most did so at least on one of those festivals annually, or certainly at least once in their lives. Although Israel was never a huge country, walking to the capital city from the north or the south would have taken, well, days. It must have been quite an experience, traveling from farms, orchards, fields, and towns, across the length and breadth of Israel through other people's places to journey to the City of Peace, Jerusalem. Once there, they had to make preparations for the festival, acquire a lamb to roast, matzah, bitter herbs to eat, provisions for themselves and their families. Without the benefit of Airbnb, they had to find accommodations in a city bursting with pilgrims, and then at the proper time, make their way to the gleaming temple to offer their own individual sacrifice. In some ways, it wasn't so different from our own Pesach preparations, the cleaning, cooking, buying, and preparing central to this holiday. Still, it would have been something to have been in Jerusalem in those long ago days and feel everyone connected to this shared experience of celebrating freedom together. Even today, it's fantastic to be in Jerusalem on Passover or Shavuot or Sukkot. Feel the energy of everybody readying themselves and then celebrating that festival throughout the city. There are times when it's reasonable to wonder just how connected the Jewish people really is to one another today. Heck, we somehow contrived to have different Shabbat Torah readings for more than 2 months. But it is festivals like these, especially Passover, when we can feel most connected to our people and our heritage. And that is something unique, special, sacred. When 85 people gathered for our own second night congregational Seder at Beit Simcha last night, that feeling couldn't be missed. May we contemporary Jews find the means to imitate the extraordinary ways our ancestors connected on these pilgrimage festivals at many other times of the year, too. And may you personally be blessed with a Chag Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and healthy holiday of Passover. When we return on To Jewish, our guest this morning, Wayne Hoffman, author of the new book, How She Died, tells us about a Jewish murder mystery solved a century and more later. He explores the death of his own great-grandmother. Find out all about it when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Gilbert Gottfried, the comic with the grating persona and loud nasal voice whose boundary testing got him temporarily canceled more than once, has died. Gottfried was just 67. He suffered from a severe heart condition related to his rare disease, myotonic dystrophy. A 2017 documentary revealed that in spite of his shouting, foul-mouthed routine, Gottfried was a sweet and loving Jewish dad and actually quite shy. Gilbert Gottfried was reluctant to let that truth escape. "I was too much of a wimp to say no to the filmmaker," he said.
"I hope you can hear the sound of my voice."
Gilbert Gottfried, who affected that loud nasal voice and shouting nonstop for comic appearances, pushed limits as a comedian, and it did get him in trouble. After he started out doing stand-up comedy by dropping out of high school at age 15, he eventually was cast for one season on Saturday Night Live. That season without Lorne Michaels, not good. Anyway, he rebounded with a number of successful movie and TV gigs. And then, in 1991, Fox had to apologize after Gilbert Gottfried, hosting the Emmy Awards, kept joking about fellow comic Pee-wee Herman's recent arrest in an adult movie theater. That dampened Gottfried's career for a while. He continued to score gigs in movies on talk radio. He was on 120 times with Howard Stern, on sketch shows and sitcoms, and as a voice on cartoons and animated features. Soon he was the unmistakable voice of the funny animal sidekick, Iago the Parrot in Disney's Aladdin. He was back on the success train. And then he famously told the very first joke about the September 11th, 2001 attacks just a few days after terrorists piloted airplanes into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. had a roast for Playboy magazine founder Hugh Hefner. Gilbert Gottfried said he had to catch an early flight for Los Angeles because the only one he could find had to make a stop at the Empire State Building. Gottfried lost the audience, but just for a moment. He recovered with one of the raunchiest ever tellings of the notoriously raunchy joke that has the aristocrats as its punchline. That didn't stop him, of course.
As a developer, Donald Trump has done so much damage to the New York skyline, instead of calling him the Donald, they should call him the 20th hijacker.
I've always said tragedy and comedy are roommates, Gilbert Gottfried said. Whenever tragedy's around, comedy's a few feet behind him, sticking his tongue out and making obscene gestures. Aflac, the insurer whose trademark duck Gottfried voiced, and which was his most lucrative gig, dropped him in 2011 when he made jokes on Twitter about the tsunami in Japan. Gottfried's self-inflicted wounds seem to be timed by, you know, decades. I don't regret the joke, he said. I regret losing the money. Aflac replaced Gilbert Gottfried as the duck with a similar voiced actor who was cheaper. Sometimes the raunchiness found Gilbert Gottfried. In 2020, during his daughter's bat mitzvah held on Zoom because of the pandemic, a 70-year-old woman unwittingly took off her bathing suit and took a shower in full view of the other attendees at the bat mitzvah. Gottfried credited his wife for turning him around from a notoriously cheap bachelor into an attentive dad who walked his two kids to Hebrew school. He met Dara Kravitz, his wife, a music executive, in the late 90s at a Grammys party he was attending because they gave free food. She dropped food on the table. He picked it up and put it on his own plate.
And if all else fails, remember, good people, blame it on the Jews.
You know, it's been a tough 6 months for comedians. Another prominent Jewish comic, Bob Saget, died recently, as did non-Jewish comedians Louis Anderson and Norm Macdonald. And Nehemiah Persoff, the late blooming actor who built one of the busiest careers in Hollywood, playing rogues, ringleaders, revolutionaries, and refugees in over 200 film and TV roles, died last week in San Luis Obispo. He was 102 years old. A self-described tough kid from the streets, Nehemiah Persoff grew up in Brooklyn during the Depression, working as a subway electrician in the late 1930s when, having shaved his head for relief from the heat in the summer, he caught the attention of an off-Broadway producer looking to add local color to his production. Nehemiah Persoff agreed to appear on stage and found the experience thrilling. In 1948, after serving in the Army in World War II, he became an early member of the Actors Studio, the workshop in New York founded by director Leah Kazan. From that elite training ground, Persoff, who was already 30, launched a prolific career in the early days of TV. With his stocky build, unnerving gaze, 5 o'clock shadow, and tightly wound energy, Persoff specialized in portraying gangland figures, Wild West desperados, bellicose generalissimos, and Cold War heavies. Trading his grimace for a warm smile on his broad face, he also played men of the cloth and workaday laborers in crisis, like his actor's studio classmate Eli Wallach, also Jewish, of course. He was in constant demand to play ethnic characters, Egyptians, Moroccans, Greeks, Italians, Russians, you name it. Nehemiah Persoff's TV career was so prodigious in the 50s and 60s, he frequently had to run between sets for episodes of shows like Rawhide and Route 66, switching wardrobes, hairpieces, mannerisms, accents at a frantic pace. Although a jovial and peaceable presence off-screen, Persoff was admired for his ability to tap into reservoirs of anger, especially when playing characters with rebelliousness against authority. If a character is within my range, I can find him within myself, said Persoff. The character is me under different circumstances. Two of his most acclaimed roles of the period in 1959 on Playhouse 90, he played Italian dictator Benito Mussolini in The Killers of Mussolini and then the melancholy Spanish guerrilla Pablo in an adaptation of Ernest Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. Nehemiah Persoff made an indelible impression in Billy Wilder's celebrated comic romp Some Like It Hot, as the crime boss Little Bonaparte proudly announces to an assembly of mobsters, "In the last fiscal year, we made $112 million before taxes, only we ain't paying no taxes." Persoff wears a hearing aid that he turns off as a spray of bullets rubs out his rivals.
Persoff's later film roles included The High Priest Shmaya and The Greatest Story Ever Told, Jewish Refugee Fleeing the Nazis in Voyage of the Damned, Barbara Streisand's Caring Father in Yentl, and the scientist behind the eugenics experiment in the comedy Twins. He was the voice of the animated Papa Mouskowitz in An American Tale and its sequels. Nehemiah Persoff was born in Jerusalem, which soon became part of the British Mandate of Palestine, in 1919. His father, a jeweler, settled with his mother in Brooklyn a decade later. Persoff attended the Hebrew Technical Institute, a vocational high school in Manhattan, doing maintenance for the city's subway system. He was allowed to attend the actor's studio because he promised to fix any broken lights. Persoff might be most famous for his scene in On the Waterfront, in which he is the cab driver, with, in the back seat, Rod Steiger and Marlon Brando. Brando doing the famous, "I could have been a contender." And then he takes Rod Steiger off for his final drive. His career was relentless through the 80s, after which he made occasional TV appearances. His final role in 2003 was as a rabbi in the HBO production of Angels in America, based on Tony Kushner's play about the AIDS epidemic. Persoff toured the country for years in the one-man show Shalom Aleichem, telling stories by the Yiddish humorist and playing some of those characters. Persoff said, "I suspect one of the most powerful forces shaping my life when I grew up in the U.S. was that German with the small mustache who questioned the right of my people and therefore me to live. I was then determined to develop whatever talent I had to prove worthy of the gift of life." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Wayne Hoffman is the author of the compelling memoir, True Detective Story, called The End of Her, Racing Against Alzheimer's to Solve a Murder. As we discussed at the beginning of the show, there's this family legend that his grandmother, his mom's mom, was your mom's grandmother was actually shot to death on her front porch in Winnipeg in the winter while she was nursing her baby, but the baby was unharmed. And now your great-grandfather remarried, and that became the only mother your mom ever knew. And then, eventually family moved to America and so on, but you were very close to your mom growing up. Tell us a little bit about your mother.
The most important thing to know about my mother is that she was hilarious. She's a great storyteller and very, very funny. My father once called her the funniest broad I ever met. And that has to be an understatement. Part of what that means is that when she told stories, and the stories were often, short anecdotes, they weren't long drawn out sagas. When she told them, they were so entertaining that people asked her to tell them again. And we certainly did growing up. And friends who knew her would ask her to tell the story again. Normally, when you're talking to a friend or a relative and they start telling a story you've already heard, you stop them and say, "Yeah, I know, you've told me the story already." No one ever did that with my mother because she was really good at it. And the fact that this one story she told was so bizarre and didn't fit in with the rest. All of her other stories were mostly perhaps exaggerations for comedic effect, but this one seemed like it was made up out of whole cloth. And I wanted to find out what the real story was, because telling stories was such an integral part of who she was and what she taught me.
So you mentioned at one point that your dad was kind of the Ed McMahon to your mom's Johnny Carson. He was the straight man sidekick, the guy who laughed at her jokes. When you started this process of kind of rediscovering this antique family story and trying to unpack what happened, your mom had already shown signs of decline.
Yes.
The book kind of documents how you, sort of brought her back, right? I mean, tried to bring her back, provoke her memory, things like that. Tell us a little bit about that process.
the process of her dementia, which we then later realized was Alzheimer's,
right,
is challenging on a million levels, because it's not amnesia. It's not that she woke up one day and forgot everything. It's that details started getting fuzzy, but they didn't necessarily disappear forever. They kind of faded in broadly reverse chronological order, slowly and then faster. But I tend to compare it to watching the ocean at low tide, where it goes out and then it comes back, not quite to the same point. And then it goes out further, and then it comes back, but not quite to the same point. So telling these stories and trying to keep her engaged was a way, not only for me to keep a conversation going with her, but was a way to sort of exercise her mind, to get her thinking and get her remembering things, particularly because this was a story she'd known since childhood. So it was going to be in her mind for a very, very long time.
Right, right.
What she had for dinner yesterday would fade very quickly, but this memory she had from her childhood would last for a long time.
Or even that she'd had dinner already that night, you know.
Correct. Or what day it was.
You know, you do some things. I mean, it's fun, you know, to go back to the Neville-y, very Jewish place to have gone on their honeymoon back in those days.
Yes. If I tell you I'm sitting here right now wearing a Neville-y t-shirt, you won't be surprised.
I am not shocked. Tell us when you started to dig into this story of your great grandmother's death. Tell us what you started to find.
Well, at first I found nothing. It took me a couple years actually to even come across the first inkling of information, because names weren't spelled the way I thought they were spelled. Finding my great grandmother, who was born Shifra Averbuch in Russia, and connecting her to the person who would later become known as Mrs. David Feinstein.
Yeah.
Which isn't even the family name we knew. We knew Feinstein spelled differently. There are many steps along the way. So it took 2 years to even find her. Once I found her, and I found the way her name was spelled at the time, I could look through some official records online in the province of Manitoba. And I found that there was a death certificate on record, and I sent away for it. And when it arrived, I saw on her death certificate that the cause of death was listed as bullet wound through brain, homicidal. And I said, my gosh, maybe the story my mother heard was true. She was murdered when she was in her 20s, and she was murdered. But then I thought, if a young mother was murdered, it was probably in the newspapers. And one of Winnipeg's dailies at the time still exists, the Free Press. So I could find their archives fairly easily. And I looked under that name and that date, and there was her picture on the front page of the paper. She was murdered. That was one of the first things I found once I got the name right. All the details my mother heard were wrong. It wasn't winter. It wasn't outside. It wasn't on the front porch. It wasn't daytime. She wasn't breastfeeding. It wasn't a drive-by sniper. No details were true, except the one that really mattered, which is that she was murdered.
She was murdered. You know, you uncover the story. By the way, a side note, your mother always resenting that she'd been called Shifra and her sister was called Malka. Couldn't have been much more Jewish. Shifra, yes, of course, right. The handmaiden, Malka queen, you know.
Right.
But she'd been named for her mother, is that correct?
For her grandmother.
For grandmother, sorry. The grandmother who was murdered, right. I keep messing up the generations, which a rabbi really should not do. So when you found this story, that must have been kind of a eureka moment.
It was, and in two different ways, because on the one hand, it was a vindication for me, because I was correct. The story my mother had told my whole life was not true. On the other hand, it was a vindication for my mother because, yes, all the details were wrong, but the most important part of it was in fact true, that her grandmother was murdered. That's, when you boil it down, that's the most important fact that was correct.
Now, as you note in, you know, kind of, I don't know, novelizing, I mean, you describe what it must have been like in the Winnipeg immigrant community in that period. There was plenty of anti-Semitism, but that anti-Semitism didn't take the form of somebody being shot in the head with a bullet.
Not generally, no. But certainly there was anti-Semitism. the Jewish community that had immigrated in the early 1900s, the first and second decade of the 1900s, mostly settled in Winnipeg's North End, which is sort of an analog to New York City's Lower East Side in a way. And it's analogous in two ways. One, in that that's where almost all the Jewish immigrants lived, but also that they weren't the only people living there. There were other immigrants who were also living there, also mostly Eastern European. So basically the people that the Jews had fled from came over with them and lived next door. So the anti-Semitism they had been fleeing from the Russian pogroms came to North America with them. And it's true, it didn't usually take on such a murderous tinge, but certainly there was anti-Semitic crime and harassment that was routine.
When, and you know, you write this story and it's, boy, it could come out of a real life TV show today. It could be a film. You know, that they investigate the murder. Clearly it's a murder. It takes place, as you noted, in none of those circumstances. It's indoors.
Correct.
I guess she's in bed with the baby.
She's asleep with children at her side.
Children at her side. And, you know, the guy, somebody shoots her in the brain.
Yes.
When you looked at the investigation, tell us a little bit about what you found.
The first thing that's evident about the investigation is that there's a language problem. And this is going to come back to haunt journalists and investigators alike. They're on the scene in a neighborhood where almost no one speaks good English. The Jewish immigrants are speaking Yiddish. The other immigrants are speaking Polish, German, Russian, Ukrainian, Hungarian, Romanian. But very few people are speaking good English. And in addition, you have a large crowd. There are hundreds of people on the street all day, while the journalists are asking questions and police are investigating. And there's sort of a game of telephone. People are gossiping and passing information along. And every time they pass it along, something gets garbled. Oh, did I say this person? I meant that person. Did I say I saw them? I meant I thought I saw them. Did I say I saw them? I meant I heard that someone else saw them. By the time you get down to the newspaper reports and the investigation, things that seem like they're all locked up and this is going to be a very quick investigation, and it's a solid case. Within 2 days, the entire case has collapsed. Every lead the police had that seemed so certain at the very beginning vanishes. It just falls apart completely within days.
You know, it's remarkable. There's a note here. You talk about how she was murdered on the Torah portion of Maaseh. And there it talks about how someone can go to a city of refuge if they've accidentally killed someone, but if intentionally killed with someone, they could be executed. Very nice touch, I have to say. Speaking as a rabbi, the mystery deepens, really, doesn't kind of diminish. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it deepens because the people who are suspected and in fact taken into custody almost immediately, within 2 days are cleared and released. And 2 days after that, the inquest that is called, which seemed like it's going to be an open and shut case, not only have the suspects been cleared and released, the only clues they have, I was going to say vanished, but in fact reappeared. The only clue the police had was that the key to the house was missing. And then when they go to start the inquest, the key to the house has reappeared. So their initial instinct that, well, we had the wrong suspects immediately, but we still know that whoever has the key is the killer. And then the key turns back up in the house and they are left with nothing. They call off the inquest and put it off for a week. Then they call off that inquest and put it off for a week. And in the end, they convict nobody. They have theories, they have suspects, and nothing comes of it. And the police essentially give up. They start offering rewards, very nice rewards, unprecedented rewards, and they double them again, and nothing comes of it. Within a few months, the case is out of the pages of the newspaper, and the police give up, and no one is charged.
You know, at that point, you'd think, okay, that's the end of the story, right? But, you know, not so much.
No. In fact, what I was trying to do once I started digging into this, into the mystery of how my great-grandmother was murdered and by whom, it also turned into a larger family story, which was, what were they doing? What was happening to the family before the murder? And also, what happened after the murder? And the family, understandably, is shattered. But eventually, my great-grandfather remarries, moves to Saskatchewan, which is something I never knew, and has more children, and carries on with a sort of blended family. Some children from his first wife, a child from his second wife's first marriage. She's widowed, as is he, and they have children together. And so it becomes a sort of family saga. If you can't solve the murder, then what can you solve? And that's what happened to the family. And that includes one of the children who was mysteriously, quote unquote, given away in my mother's telling of the story. And as I was trying to figure out what happened to the family after the murder, I said, let me figure out what happened to that child who was given away, which I also never believed.
Right.
What really happened to her? And that also took years, but I did find out what happened to her. And once again, the story my mother heard was not right, but it also wasn't entirely wrong.
The story, by the way, of the funeral, there's like 3,000 people that attend, and it's the middle of summer. I mean, there's nothing about that original story that's true, except that she's murdered.
Correct. And the funeral is the largest Winnipeg had ever seen. And it's not only that it's summer, it's a very warm day in August. There's only one Jewish cemetery in Winnipeg at that point. And in fact, it's not even in Winnipeg. It's across the river in Transcona, which is a new hamlet. Now it's part of Winnipeg. Mm-hmm. But at that point, people had to walk into this only recently incorporated other town across the to walk 5 miles in the summer heat.
To get to the funeral.
And to get to the funeral. And mind you, this is 1913. People weren't wearing shorts and tank tops.
No.
So it's, and once you get there, you then have to walk back.
Right.
So it's quite a procession.
Quite a tribute, and really, to your great...
It is. And also, there are, at that point in Winnipeg, two rival rabbis. There's the official chief rabbi of Winnipeg, and there's his main rival, who the Yiddish paper at the time calls the second chief rabbi. That's not an official position. That's just what they called him. The two of them come together for the funeral, and both officiate. Which, as far as I know, is something that rarely happened, because they had separate congregations and separate followings. And they were two people who often publicly disagreed. And here, for this day, they came together.
It's a fascinating story. There's a whole lot more there. And you are quite the investigative detective. I commend it. The book is called The End of Her. Where can people go to find out more about you and about the book, Wayne?
They can go to my website, which is waynehoffmanwriter.com. They can find me on Instagram at waynehoffmanwriter. Or you can look for the book on Amazon, in paperback, hardback, ebook, audiobook, or call your favorite bookstore and have them order it.
Thank you so much, Wayne.
Thank you.
The book is called The End of Her, Racing Against Alzheimer's to Solve a Murder. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week when our guest will be Susan Lax, co-owner of Na'ot, author of the new book, A Heart's Landscape, An Introduction to a Garden of Moments. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning on Two Jewish comes for the end of the Seder, the song Ki Lo Na'eh. My friends, may you have a truly Chag Sameach, a Zis and Pesach, a happy holiday of Passover, a healthy week, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Adir bin Lucha Bachur Kalacha Kiddudav Yom Rulo Dagu Bimlucha Adun Kalacha Basikav Yom Rulo Lecha 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 Ki Lecha 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 Hashem Mamam Lecha 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 Ki Lecha 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 Hashem Mamam Lecha Ki Lo Nawe Ki Lo Yawe Ki Lo Nawe Ki Lo Yawe Ki Lo Nawe Ki Lo
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.